Hello, good afternoon. My name is Lisa Falsko. I'm the CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council. It's my pleasure to welcome everyone here today. We have a sold-out crowd, and it's so great to see so many faces. Today, we have a wonderful bread basket raffle from Great Harvest Bread, and there's just a few raffle tickets in that bucket. So if you want to have a chance at something where you have a very good odds, you have about 2 minutes to go up to the head table while I finish my notes and grab a ticket. If you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. Today's program is being recorded for KSKA. So if you could just turn your phones off or put them on vibrate, that would be greatly appreciated. This program will be available for download on alaskapublic.org's website. And you can also get a link to it from our website. And you will be able to find all of our past programs as well. I'd like to thank William Toyer for doing the recording today. He records our programs for KSKA. And like I said, just go to alaskapublic.org to listen to those. Later this week, you'll also be able to watch a behind-the-scenes video. This morning, I was able to interview our guest speaker. And so if you want to get a little bit more information, that will also be on alaskapublic.org, as well as Alaska World Affairs Council YouTube. We are a membership organization, and if you are currently not a member, please consider joining our organization to help our student programs and help bring our speakers to Alaska. There's more information on the tables. If this is your first Alaska World Affairs Council, if you could raise your hand. Do we have any new people? Ah, wonderful, great. Super, well, thank you for coming. And if you enjoyed today's program, our next program is going to be on a Wednesday. It is November 28th, where we have a specialist on energy policies in Asia, and he'll be talking about Alaska LNG opportunities in Japan, China, and other Asian markets. On the table, you might have noticed there's also a card for information about the Alaska World Affairs Council Endowment Fund. We have established an endowment fund and to make this opportunity for programs for future generations. And if you'd like to donate to this fund, Cornerstone General Contracting, or General Contractors, is now offering to match up to $2,500, all donations made up to that amount prior to the end of the year. So please take a card and consider the Alaska World Affairs Council Endowment Fund. You may have noticed that we have updated our website. You can now go see all of our programs on the website. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can also hashtag AKWorld and tell people what you think about the programs. If you're a student, could you please stand and be recognized? Do we have any students here today? Fabulous, fabulous. Thank you so much for coming. I know we have a lot of students today from Chugiak and Eagle River, and thank you for coming, and thank you so much to BP for sponsoring the students' programs and making it possible for all students to come to Alaska World Affairs Council programs at no cost. Thank you, BP. And speaking of students, I'd like to recognize we have a special guest in our audience today, our very own superintendent, Dr. Jim Browder. Sorry, you didn't know I was going to embarrass you. Thank you so much for coming. Who is accompanied by Tam Augusta Giesler, who you probably know as a school board member, but she's also a past Alaska World Affairs Council board member. Tam, great to see you. And I'd like to thank our speaker today for going to West High School this morning, where she spoke to about 70 students on this topic, and there were a lot of fantastic questions. So if any students have questions, please feel free to ask her anything at the end. At this time, I'd like to introduce our head table. To my far left is Mr. Chuck Becker, who is a board member emeritus of our council and gives a lot of great advice on our direction. And to his right is William Toyer, who, like I said, records all of our programs, a super volunteer, and gives endless hours to the Alaska World Affairs Council, Mr. William Toyer. And to his right, we have a new board member, Tori Allen, who is, you might have known from the opera days, the director of the opera, but now he's with alaskapublic.org, KSKA, KAKM, and also on our board of directors and chair of our program committee, Tori Allen. And to his right, I'd like to bring, before I do that, I see a sign here. Breadbasket, I almost forgot. If we could have our speaker draw the lucky winning ticket.
Yes, absolutely.
She's closing her eyes. Okay, if you are number 567952, right for Thanksgiving, congratulations. You've won a bread basket. And now I'd like to call up Chuck Becker, our vice chair of our board, who will be introducing our speaker today. Chuck.
Oh, sorry.
Chuck Colson, excuse me.
Too many Chucks at the head table, I think. I'm Chuck Colson. I'm vice chair this year for the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it's my privilege today to introduce Dr. Farideh Farhi. Dr. Farhi is an independent scholar and affiliate on the graduate faculty at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, something all Alaskans, I think, would be very jealous of, where she teaches Middle East politics. She's also taught comparative politics at the University of Colorado Boulder, University of Tehran, and the Shahid Beheshti University in Tehran. Her publications include States and Urban-Based Revolutions in Iran and Nicaragua, as well as numerous articles and book chapters on comparative analysis of revolutions and on Iran's politics and foreign policy. Dr. Farhi spent most of the 1990s in Iran teaching, as well as working as a research associate and English editor at the Institute for Political and International Studies. She has served as a consultant to the World Bank and the International Crisis Group, and has been a grant recipient of the United States Institute of Peace. Most recently, she was a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Dr. Farhi is here today to speak to us on Iran's nuclear policy and its impact on the region. Please, let's give us a warm welcome.
Okay, I'm a little bit short, so I have to always adjust this. Let me get my act together. Okay. As we say in Honolulu, aloha, kaku. Yes, I think it is. I just want to make sure, I'm sorry, this is not going to abandon me. I thought I did do what I needed to do technologically, but it always, okay, it's going to work out, I think. It's a great pleasure to be here. Let me begin by thanking the Alaska World Council, particularly Lisa, Kari, and Will, who picked me up from the airport, for inviting me here, making it possible logistically. It is always a great pleasure to be in this magnificent state. Very different from Hawaii, I must say, but kindred spirits in terms of the enjoyment us residents get from the stunning physical beauty of the place. I cannot get over what is in front of me, so if I'm distracted, apologize. I apologize in advance. I lived most of my childhood in Tehran, a city that is mile high and is surrounded by very similar mountains. So it's also a nostalgic feeling for me. Although I must say, Tehran's mountains no longer look like this because we can't see them anymore because of pollution. But that, fortunately, is not a problem you have here. What I like to do here is essentially divide my talk into three sections that I hope follow each other logically. I will begin with the problems United States has had with Iran and the way it has tried to deal with Iran, a state or a country that has been a problem for United States at least since 1979 when it had its revolution. I will particularly give emphasis to what has happened during President Obama's presidency. I will then talk about a little bit about domestic politics in Iran and the impact these policies have had on Iranian politics and what Iran is going through at this particular moment, particularly since negotiations with the United States are about to come. At the same time, Iran is about to get prepared for its own presidential election, which is a very important election because it's an end of an era, the end of the hardline president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's presidency, because he can no longer run, thankfully. And from my point of view, and I'm sure, so it's an important election that is coming up, so I'd like to talk a little bit about that. And I'm going to end with essentially an argument that I think the U.S. government has reached a critical decision point regarding how it wants to resolve the Iran problem, and I'll explain that. The reality is that despite all the campaign talk about Iran and what to do about Iran, everything in relation to Iran has been hanging in suspension, awaiting the results of U.S. elections. And with the election now behind us, speaking in generalities, in order to avoid what I will argue is the real Iran question, will not do us any good, and in fact, I would argue, may have very dangerous consequences, not only for Iran, which may become subject of military attack or confronted with political instability, but also for the Middle East region in general, as well as U.S. standing in the region. In all honesty, from my point of view, Iran as a country that is about 75 million people, or three times the size of Iraq, and military spending of about $10 to $15 billion, which is about one-tenth of military spending in the United States, has never deserved being identified as one of the biggest threats to the United States or the world, no matter how much that position boosts the Iranian ego. You know, Iranians like to be the best in the world and the biggest. And in reality, the resources Iran has, its size, and its history does not warrant that kind of designation. Yet, as the most populous and largest country at the heart of the highly significant oil-producing Persian Gulf region, it is also a country whose aspiration for a more powerful role and having a seat in the decision-making table for the region cannot be ignored either. I always say Iran is an inspiring power, but because its aspirations are always stunted, it is also an uncomfortable power. And it is that dynamic that makes it difficult to deal with Iran. So let me begin with a review of U.S. policy in general and President Obama's approach in particular. As many of you may know, for years the United States has identified Iran as having four problems. First, it's Iran's nuclear program. Second is its aiding of terrorism. In fact, Tehran is routinely identified as the chief sponsor of terrorism because of its support for Hezbollah in Lebanon and various Palestinian groups also identified as terrorists in the United States, but not necessarily elsewhere. For example, Hezbollah is very important to realize is not identified as a terrorist group in Europe. Third, it's Iran's opposition. It used to be the peace process, but now that the peace process is effectively defunct, and courtesy of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's blustery rhetoric against Israel, it is Iran's opposition to Israel itself that is at the core of Iran's problem. And finally, but not the least, is Iran's human rights record, which is routinely considered and quite bleakly, in fact. Since the Iranian Revolution, U.S.-Iran relations have gone through many ups and downs, but mostly downs. Washington has accused Iran of being behind attacks on the American military forces in Lebanon as early as 1983, all the way to skirmishes in Iraq. Iran, in turn, has never forgotten the American support of Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war and the American decision to close his eyes to Saddam Hussein's extensive use of chemical weapons against not only Iranian military forces, but Iranian civilians. In fact, one could argue that the history of U.S.-Iran relations has been a litany of mutual grievances against each other, with rare but significant instances of cooperation, including cooperation in the invasion of Afghanistan and creation of the new Afghan state in the 2001-2002 period. So these significant cooperation periods should not be forgotten, and I'll get back to that, because I think when people talk about U.S. and Iran relationship as completely being opposite to each other in terms of interest, I would like to point out that that is not really the case. In fact, you have significant, Iran and United States have significant interests that are mutual. Now, the reality, however, is that despite the multiplicity of interests and grievances, it has been Iran's nuclear program that has been at the center stage of almost 10 years now, at least since 2003. Essentially, the issue revolves around whether the Islamic Republic should be allowed to have a nuclear fuel cycle. Tehran insists that under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, it does have the right to produce fuel, and to do that, it can enrich uranium. The United States, on the other hand, argues that because of past violations of its safeguard agreements of the NPT, Iran cannot be trusted to pursue fuel cycle because that enrichment of uranium can eventually turn into or be used for weapons use. In fact, the several United Nations Security Council resolutions all insist that Iran has to suspend its enrichment activities. Now, it's important also understand that United States used to be opposed to any kind of nuclear activities in Iran, but that is a red line that Iran has passed many years ago, and in fact, Iran now has the only energy-producing nuclear plant in the Middle East. Israel may have a nuclear plant that produces bombs, but does not have an energy-producing nuclear plant. Iran now has, with the help of Russians, an energy-producing and working nuclear plant. So the red line that Iran should not have any nuclear activity has already been passed. Iran objects to United Nations Security Council resolutions that tells Iran not to produce or not to enrich uranium because it says it's illegal. It essentially says that the violation that Iran engaged in were not severe enough to create the conditions for referral of Iran to the United Nations Security Council. It says that it was only made possible, and this is the language I'm using, the Iranians use, by American bullying. So United States is essentially represented as a bully that has come into a region that is not its own region and is trying to tell everybody how to run their business. Now, President Bush's rejection of Iran's enrichment program was so emphatic that until almost the end of his presidency, he did not even allow United States representatives to participate in a process of negotiation initiated by three European countries, United Kingdom, Germany, and France, unless Iran suspended all its enrichment-related activities. In other words, for most of George Bush's presidency, simply talking to Iran was premised on a precondition and conceived as a reward to Iran if that country did what United States wanted it to do before it entered the negotiation. Okay, this is a problem, as we will see, United States still has, one way or another. Although United States has gone, under the Obama administration, we have begun to go. Beyond that, diplomacy with Iran, engagement with Iran is always conceived as a reward, and therefore we don't want to give Iran a reward. And that has created a major stumbling block for talks. Now, President Obama came to office with a very bold agenda on Iran, which was intended to distinguish him not only from George Bush, but also from his domestic opponent, Hillary Clinton. Obama said he would try to negotiate with Iran without preconditions. Furthermore, even though he did not say so explicitly, he did hint at the possibility of a strategic reorientation towards Iran, a reorientation that would allow the resolution of the nuclear issue, but open the path for broader cooperation with Iran on a number of issues, including, as I suggested before, for instance, political developments and economic developments in Afghanistan, and also a variety of issues like control of drug trade, a drug problem. Drug trade is a real issue for Iran as a neighboring country to Afghanistan. And of course, these drugs eventually end up in Europe and United States. So there are potential for tremendous kind of cooperation. He did, in fact, say in his famous Cairo speech to the Islamic world, there will be many issues to discuss between our two countries, and we are willing to move forward without preconditions on the basis of mutual respect. The term mutual respect is a catchword for the Iranians because they always say America is the arrogant power. And in fact, that's the, you know, many times United States is not even mentioned. Just arrogant power, we know it's United States. So it was very important. The notion of mutual respect, you know, indicated a sense of equality in negotiations. But President Obama was also very clear that although he was contemplating the idea of some sort of strategic realignment, the tactical frame of America's approach would essentially remain the same as the Bush administration. So what was that tactical frame? That approach has come to be known as the dual-track approach of diplomacy. Some people call it a stick and carrot, you know, sanctions and talking. And of course, the Iranians always say stick and carrot. What, are we donkeys? You know, they keep talking about us that way. I think of it in a different form of imaginary, which is to shake with one hand and slap the face with the other hand. I don't know why anybody thinks that approach would work with any country, but it has been the frame of American foreign policy approach to Iran. So what do we have after 4 years of Obama presidency? I would argue that Obama's Iran policy can be characterized by strategic ambivalence, perhaps even confusion, combined with tactical resolution and significant success. This policy has been able to place significant economic squeeze, particularly on the Iranian middle classes and private sector, while at the same time moving very little towards reduction of tensions between the two countries. In fact, if anything, Obama policy has occasioned an angrier and even more provocative Iranian foreign policy. More disconcerting, from the point of view of our interest in the United States, it has even occasioned a more advanced Iranian nuclear program. Now, how did this happen? Actually, President Obama had a great start. Even before the Cairo speech, on the occasion of Iranian New Year, which is March 21st of every year, beginning of the spring, so in March 2009, he gave what is called a Nowruz speech, a New Year's speech, directly to the Iranian public. It was translated and widely disseminated in Iran. And in that speech, he did three things. First of all, he did not make a distinction between Iranian people and the Iranian government. no more Iranian people are great, Iranian government is bad. You know, he talked to both of them at the same time and said he's ready to talk. Secondly, he did not talk about hardliners versus moderates, the hardliners that are bad or are actually in charge of negotiation and moderates who are good and powerless. He talked about the Iranian government in its totality. Finally, he stated his commitment to meaningful diplomacy. He said, it is time for engagement that is honest and grounded in mutual respect and addresses concerns of both. The process, he said, in no uncertain terms, will not be advanced by threats. He said so. This was, of course, the closest thing anyone in the U.S. had come to rule out the military option. Of course, we now know, thanks to David Sanger of New York Times, that exactly at the same time that Mr. Obama was saying will not be advanced by threats, Mr. Obama was cooperating with the Israeli government to send very, very destructive viruses, specifically Stuxnet virus, into Iranian nuclear plants. So, Mr. Obama's, again, going back to this notion that his tactical frame essentially remained the same, it's important to understand that as he was extending his hand, this hand was not necessarily keeping out other options. But, nevertheless, response from Tehran was positive, even if conditional. Most importantly, 2 days after Mr. Obama spoke, the response came not from President Ahmadinejad, but from Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, the Ayatollah, who is constitutionally is in charge of delineating the general direction of the country. So it's very important to understand, no matter what the president in Iran does or the parliament, it is ultimately Mr. Khamenei that has to okay it, because establishing relations with the United States, a relationship that has been destroyed since 1979, is a major redirection of the country. And it is the supreme leader that has to decide to do that. So he said he's ready to talk. But he also said, our nation dislikes it when you again proclaim talk with pressure. He saw this as a policy of threat and inducement, and he said, you cannot talk to our nation this way. It is condescending, arrogant, and patronizing. And he left no doubts that further squeezing of Iran leading up to talks and during the talks will be seen by Iran as a sign that President Obama was not serious about negotiations. Nevertheless, as I said, he also signaled the talk. Now, this was March 2009. Something major happened in Iran in June 2009, which was Iran's presidential election, in which Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was running for a second term. He was expected to get reelected, but Iran has a peculiar political system that I think is very strange to everybody, every other place in the world. Elections in Iran are not completely controlled. They are engineered, as they say. The candidates, you know, sort of vetted, and who can run is vetted. But usually about 60% of the population votes, which is higher from what we see in the United States. But in some elections, and it has happened, it happened in 1991, it happened in, a parlementary election in 1996, suddenly there is a 20% shift. Can you imagine what would happen in the United States if suddenly from 60% of population voting, 85% voted? There'd be a revolution in the United States, no? I would argue. I mean, the system will become destabilized. The electoral system will have a serious issue. First of all, the voting lines will be so long that people won't be able to vote anyway. But that also happened in Iran. And a candidate that was not expected to win, at least a good part of the Iranian population, particularly in the urban areas, thought that he had won the election. And Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was elected through fraud. So that created an uproar and massive demonstrations in Iran, bringing issues related to human rights that is also another concern of American foreign policy. I'm not going to get into the details. We can talk about it in question answer. The point was that this jolted both sides considerably. Nevertheless, by October 2009, both sides were ready to talk. And in fact, when they met in Geneva, and for the first time, they met within the frame of what has come to be known P5 plus one, five permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany. Iran met with them, and for the first time, United States and Iran went to other room, to the side, and had a conversation, bilateral conversation, a short conversation, and they came out of the meeting with a tentative agreement, which was Iran would ship out its the amount of uranium enriched inside Iran to Russia and then to France, and then it would get back fuel plates for a Tehran research reactor that is running out of fuel. This Tehran research reactor, by the way, was put into place in Iran by Americans, and used to be run by 90% enriched uranium, but now it's run on 20% enriched uranium because of the Argentinian help. Now, if that breakthrough had happened, we would be in a completely different trajectory because it was an important confidence-building measure. But the reality was that Iran was in a very uncomfortable post-election environment. The government was engaged in massive repression domestically to put down massive demonstrations in the streets, and this deal with the United States was perceived inside Iran as government making a deal with the United States in order to continue repression inside. Okay, so across the board, you know, all political players, even the presidential candidate that presumably had won and now was pushed out, opposed the deal because of this fear. It's whenever I talk about Iran to people, I have to remind everybody that Iran also has politics. And it comes as a shock to everybody because we usually only think of United States having politics. Maybe we agree that in the Middle East, Israel has politics, but Iran also having a domestic politics is a shock. Because we have a tendency to think of other Middle Eastern countries, Arab or Iranians, as essentially having one dictator at the top that can decide. And today he decides no, and tomorrow he decides yes. The reality was that this arrangement clearly showed that even the supreme leader that had okayed the deal originally had to back down eventually. Now, the Iranian leadership tried once more to get this, but it didn't work out. Through the intervention of the Brazilians and the Turks. Now, the Iranian leadership was obviously at fault in this process because it did not get the country ready for this deal. However, I would argue that President Obama or the Obama administration was also not fault-free. If the U.S. was intent to strike a bargain limiting enrichment program and instituting a robust inspection regime, then once the agreement encountered domestic opposition, United States could have canceled forbearance, allowing the P5-1 to wait for a counteroffer from Iran. Instead, impatient with Iran's messy environment, political environment, and Iran's politics, believe me, is messy, the U.S. chose the familiar path. And what is the familiar path? which is announcement of deadlines, patronizing speeches, ominous reminders that the clock was ticking, in effect, Washington's offer of the transfer deal, which was a tentative agreement to begin with, turned into an ultimatum. Either you accept this or the deal is off the table. In short, Obama's Iran policy since then has effectively been taken over by the Treasury Department and the Office of Undersecretary for Financial and Terrorism Intelligence. The end game was no longer in sight, and the game essentially became efficient implementation of squeezing procedures by an ever-expanding bureaucracy in the Treasury Department. That was the only thing that was left of Obama's reset button. Now, this dynamic again changed. How did it change? Well, it changed because of a technological breakthrough in Iran. The American leadership had assumed that given Iran's need for 20% enrichment for the Tehran Research Reactor, which is a reactor that produces a lot of medicine or material needed for nuclear-related medicine, that the Iranians would eventually be back on the negotiation table with a weaker hand. But Iran's ability to produce 20% enriched uranium and fuel plates to boot for the use in Tehran Research Reactor once again brought to the fore the dangers of not negotiating with Iran. Iran not only could produce what it was denied, it showed the capability of inching closer to having a nuclear weapons capability. Even more worrisome, it began to produce enriched uranium under a mountain facility called Fordo that is presumably safeguarded against an aerial attack, even bunker busters. Of course, we may be testing that soon. You could say that this was Iran's response to the famous line uttered by both President Bush and President Obama that regarding Iran, all options are on the table. Now, it's important to remember that this facility is under full supervision of the International Atomic Agency, but remains problematic precisely because if inspectors are kicked out, it can presumably be defended even against aerial attacks. So by this spring, two things were happening at the same time. On the one hand, the Obama administration, with the help of Congress and European allies, was able to put into place a ferocious sanctions regime, almost unprecedented in the history of the world, which by now, the only thing it is not doing is directly a full embargo of Iranian oil. Instead, it has gone for the financial heart of the Iranian economic system. It is an embargo on the Iranian central bank, okay? And insurance companies and shipping companies that take Iranian oil. Iran oil exports have dropped 40 to 50%. But it has also created all sorts of problems. For example, United States says that these are smart sanctions that are intended towards the leadership in Iran. In reality, the financial sanctions have also prevented, for example, importation of medicine into Iran because the Iranians can import, but they cannot pay for them. Okay? So that ferociousness of the sanctions regime is the hallmark of Obama administration's success. On the other hand, however, Iran has been able steadily to increase its nuclear capability and make it more protected from attacks. Rather than checking Iran's nuclear ambitions, the sanctions regime has been prodding Iran towards inching closer to what experts call nuclear weapons capability, or the ability, as I said, to put together a nuclear bomb rapidly if it decides to do so. However, it is also important to remember that as of today, United States' best intelligence estimate is that Iran has not made the decision to weaponize. The International Atomic Energy Agency has not found any evidence of the diversion. And in order to presumably give confidence that Iran does not want to produce a nuclear weapon, Iran's supreme leader has issued a religious edict publicly to its own population that Iran is not interested. Not only is not interested, it considers it to be religiously illicit to construct and use nuclear weapons. So these two dynamics, sanctions as well as Iran's progress, essentially created the dynamics for another round of negotiations that began last, several months ago, went all the way to early summer. First in Istanbul, then in Baghdad, and finally in Russia. These talks began auspiciously with the Obama administration giving a hint that it's ready to address some of Iran's bottom lines. And remember, Iran's bottom line is that it cannot be treated differently from other countries in the world who have signed the non-proliferation treaty. If the treaty gives countries to enrich, the right to enrich, Iran will not give up that right, just because it is being pressured. However, United States went to Russia essentially asking Iran to concede several things at the same time. Ship out its 20% enrichment, the higher level, abandon enrichment of 20%, and also close Fordo, the military side, the protected side. Of course, the Iranians would not accept that position because American position on everything is on, all options are on the table, is still on the table. Iranians would be stupid to give up Fordo when all options are still on the table. The problem was complicated by Washington's refusal to actually publicly acknowledge that it accepts enrichment in Iran at a lower level. Iranians, on the other side, came up with this idea of step-by-step process. The Russians supported it too, which you give something, you take something. So if we're going to ship out a 20% enriched uranium, you reduce some of the sanctions. Of course, the Americans could not trust the Iranians, for justifiable reasons, perhaps, that thinking that something that has worked to bring the Iranians to the table, if you take it away, then the Iranians would abandon the rest of the negotiation process. In the midst of all this thing, of course, was the American elections and pressures brought to bear by both Republicans as well as the hardline government of Israel to continue the stance of not allowing any enrichment in Iran, and even go further and set a red line or a deadline that would shift U.S. posture from one of finding a negotiated solution to the problem to a militaristic one. Of course, as many of you know, during the campaign, finally it was Secretary Clinton that put a stop to that kind of talk. And essentially once Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel talked about the red line that if Iran passes, United States should engage in an attack, Secretary Clinton cleverly said, no foreign government can set a deadline for us. So she changed the language a little bit and essentially pointed out to the American public that the Obama administration, no matter how close to the Israeli government, would not be willing or should be willing to allow foreign governments to set criteria for United States. So, now the campaign is over, and by the end of this month, a new set of talks will apparently begin. Both sides have indicated that they are ready to do so. There is also much speculation about whether or not these talks will eventually turn into bilateral talks. There's tremendous about debate in Iran regarding this issue, whether to do it or not. And of course, in the United States, you also have a contentious environment. Sanctions have made life very difficult for Iran. Some of you might have heard Iranian currency has devalued by two-thirds. And as I said, Iran has problems as varied as selling its oil to getting medicine for its population. For me, as someone who has its roots in Iran, the problem with this approach is that the hardship of the people and certain sectors of the population, particularly the private sector, should not be interpreted as impacting behavior in the desired direction. In fact, sanctions as a tool that effectively create limitations on the free market or economic decisions. And like every political or economic decisions, they impact different sectors of a society differently. So, and in fact, while they may be harming a certain sector of the society, they are actually benefiting another sector of the society. In fact, if you go to Tehran today, you will be very surprised, because on the one hand, you will see tremendous difficulty on the part of a variety of groups, as I said, independent middle-class folks, a private sector, but you also, on the other hand, you see Tehran full of Maseratis and Ferraris, and so somebody is making money in Iran. And you can bet that when you have a sanctions regime, that kind of money is being made by networks that are not transparent, probably associated with the security hardline sectors of the Iranian government that can keep that non-transparency going on, and essentially creating a mafia state in Iran, rather than enhancing transparency and prodding Iran towards a more democratic. So the sanctions have empowered hardliners economically, but they have also empowered the hardliners in Iran politically, because it has given them an argument. The argument is that the United States is not after the resolution of the nuclear issue. Nuclear issue is an excuse. And the escalating pressure is push for regime change and instability in Iran. So, as we await yet another round of talks with P5+1, the basic question for United States government to answer at this point is not whether all options are on the table or whether we could impose more sanctions on Iran. We can, of course, do both. I mean, United States, if United States attacks Iran, is not going to put boots on the ground, but certainly United States can bomb the hell out of Iran. No doubt, no one doubts that. We have enough toys to do it, you know. No one doubts that. But we should ask ourselves a more basic question, which is whether the United States, after years of offering what it knew Iran would refuse, because it never addressed Iran's bottom line, whether the United States is willing to offer something that Iran can accept given its contentious political environment. Now, everyone knows what the elements of that offer, the offer is. Limits on levels of enrichment combined with a more robust inspection regime in exchange for calibrated reduction of some of the sanctions. Some of these sanctions, Iranians even know, will never go away, because they have been instituted by United States Congress. And you know, sanctions instituted by United States Congress never go away. But some sanctions are executive order, some sanctions are European sanctions, so those can be negotiated, and that's good enough for Iran. Why do I say United States is approaching a decision time, a rapidly approaching decision time regarding which direction to go? As I said, sanctions have worked very well. But in Iran, the leadership, instead of talking about giving in, which is not an option politically, domestically, is hunkering down and is talking about a resistance economy. Now, the current leadership does want a deal. The history of negotiations suggests that. But these encounters have also shown that it perceives itself as standing at the helm of a highly contentious political terrain that demands addressing certain bottom line. With the draconian measures, the same contentious terrain makes it quite impossible to accept a deal that doesn't address bottom line. I'm almost done. Some would say that let's go for the jugular. Precisely because Iran is weak, this is the time to go for the jugular and try to get rid of this regime that is just awful and has been a thorn in our eyes. I would say that we've tried that in Iraq. We've tried that in Syria. It's not working out very well. These folks are not going to go away. The only hope that you have is trying to steer this giant ship in a different direction. Presidential elections are coming up in Iran in June 2003. A deal with the United States will actually allow the forces that are very vibrant in Iran to impact that election and move the country towards the center. If that does not happen, I think Iranian politics has tremendous potential to remain radical for years to come. Thank you.
Dr. Farhi has graciously offered to answer some questions. I know we're running out of time, but if you could just wait for the microphone because this is being recorded for the radio, and state your question to Dr. Farhi.
Thank you for a very enlightening talk. How much influence will Ahmadinejad have on the election in June? Will he be able to influence his successor?
Thank you for that question. Of course, that's a question a lot of people ask. I can only give you my analysis of it. I think Ahmadinejad is over, is finished. And the reason I think he's over and finished is essentially because his policies have proven disastrous. And not only they have proven disastrous because they were wrong, but because of the miscalculations that it entailed. Ahmadinejad said that the sanctions are just a torn paper. Nobody gives them attention. It turns out that that was not true. You know, the Obama administration was able to institute a very robust sanctions regime. So Iranian economy has tanked. More importantly, his basic platform to his base, which was the platform of economic justice, it's quite obvious when you go to Iran how that has not worked out. As I say, you go to Iran, it's just incredible the display of wealth that you see in the streets of Iran by a group of Iranians that have obviously benefited from Ahmadinejad's presidency. So as far as I'm concerned, I mean, people talk about that he has his own candidate and he's gonna go around the country and campaign. You know, Iran does have American-style campaign system with all sorts of people coming out. And I just simply do not think that he has, and he has lost the support of almost every constituency that supported his presidency 4 years ago, including the support of the Supreme Leader. The language in Iran at this point, and I'm not joking, people talk this way, and I'm talking about Speaker of the Parliament, Deputy Speaker, is not a good idea to get rid of him, impeach him now, because there is only 6 months left to the election. So let's keep the system tranquil, you know, peaceful, so we can have these negotiations, and then he'll leave in 6 months and so on. Now, that doesn't mean that he's gonna leave peacefully. He's gonna kick and yell and do whatever he can. Right now, there is a big conflict between the parliament and Ahmadinejad. They want to bring him to the parliament to answer questions with the potential for impeachment. But, so there's going to be a lot of tensions. But as far as his future, he's over. He really does not have any constituency in Iran left for him anymore. And once he loses control over the resources of the state, he doesn't have money to pass around. Therefore, he's over, I think.
Thank you for coming over and talking to us. I believe that President Ahmadinejad is just a puppet there, truly. Because on one hand, we say the Ayatollah, nothing goes without the Ayatollah. But at the same time, we're saying it's President Ahmadinejad that is can sway people or not people. He's not talking without the Ayatollah dictating the rule. What is the Ayatollah saying? And that's the question I think that we truly, the world needs to answer. It's not President Ahmadinejad.
On the nuclear issue, certainly you're absolutely correct. And the conversation in Iran is very clear on that. Constitutionally, as I suggested, it is the supreme leader that will decide the direction of the country, the policy direction of the country. And on the nuclear issue and talks with the United States, that is at the level of direction of the country. So you're absolutely correct. What does he think? He's extremely suspicious of the Obama administration because of this four-year experience. He's extremely suspicious of American government in general. They say America is America. America is a bully. And America's interest is to get rid of us. Whether that's true or not, we'll find out soon enough. But this is the point I was trying to make. At different periods, he felt that there is a potential for some sort of a resolution of the nuclear conflict because the United States may show flexibility, he has allowed talks to go on. So between 2003 to 2005, even though the negotiators say that he kept saying the Europeans are not going to come through, they only listened to Bush administration and Bush says no and Europeans, he allowed it. Okay, but then when the negotiations failed, he came and said, I told you so. And he's going to do exactly the same thing this time around, essentially because this is a good moment, okay, to engage in negotiation. Iran has been harmed, so United States isn't in a strong position. But the point is that if United States does not show flexibility, if it does not go for some sort of a compromise that allows him to go back to this contentious political terrain to say that we got something out of these negotiations, he's just going to say no. He will not accept a negotiation. The good news is that all the conflicts that has occurred between Ahmadinejad and Khamenei, the conservatives in Iran, the hardliners, for the past 2 years have come up with this idea that everything that the leader says is it. So for the past 2 years, they have wedded themselves to his point of view. So if he says yes, which the centrists want him to say yes, and the reformists want him to say yes, the hardliners have to be quiet. Because they have elevated him to the level of God and have said that whatever he says is true. So that's why internally we are in a very good position, if United States is interested in some sort of a deal, to actually come up with some sort of a compromise. It's the best time. You know, the history of U.S.-Iran relations has always been one side has been ready, the other side was not. Iran sent an offer in 2003 to the Bush administration to resolve all issues the Bush administration was not even willing to look at. During the Clinton administration, they were ready to engage more the Iranian political. This is a fabulous. It's not going to get better than this. All I'm trying to suggest to you. However, it can get very worse.
Hi, thank you very much for speaking to us. My question is, what does Iran see as threats, as a rationale for developing nuclear weapons, or do you think it really desires to have nuclear weapons? Or?
I do not. Iran has signed the NPT, and I'm not the only one saying. The American intelligence community is saying that Iran has not made a decision to build a nuclear weapon. NPT is very clear. As a signatory to NPT, Iran has promised not to build nuclear weapons. weapons. Does Iran want to become a nuclear-capable state? Maybe. However, the policies that have been pursued has made it to inch closer to becoming a nuclear-capable state. As I said, Iran sees this nuclear issue actually as its trump card through which it can resolve its problems with the United States. Okay? And therefore, every time the United States says no, it gives it an incentive to advance the program even more, so it would have more of a card to go to negotiations. So United States' trump card are sanctions. Iran's trump card in the negotiation, you know, is advancement in its nuclear weapons. So in many ways, Iran is becoming a nuclear weapons, nuclear capable state willy-nilly, you know, in this dance that is going on. I personally think it can be stopped. Iran does want to have a deterrent capability insofar as nobody attacking it. Iran has not been an aggressive state, has not invaded, has not breached any borders in the past 200 years. It was invaded by Iraq. And I do think that it does have a degree of deterrent. You know, it would be really awful for the United States to attack a country aerially that has a nuclear plant. Okay, I mean, people don't understand, you know. I mean, people, when they say, let's go and attack Iran's nuclear facilities, some of these facilities, if they are attacked, they are environmental catastrophes, not even disaster. So this kind of language that people use about attacking Iran, but nevertheless, that advantage that Iran has now developed, it has not been able to turn it into concrete steps whereby this notion of all options are on the table, including ferocious sanctions, are taken off the table.
If you could, we have time for one more question, but if Carl, you could take one from a student after this, and that'd be great.
Proliferation is a pretty hot topic. However, my question as a UA student, my question regards to what is the Iranian government doing as far as their sanctions, is not regarding the U.S., but their surroundings as well. I still have friends in Afghanistan, and the war probably hasn't hit directly between the two nations. But what is the Iranian government in regard what they're thinking as far as our war that we're fighting?
Okay. Afghanistan is actually a very good topic to discuss as an example of a place where U.S.-Iran relations are almost the same, exactly the same. They both want a stable Afghanistan. They do not want Taliban in power. They both together put together the framework of this new government. If Iran was not in Bonn, okay, the Northern Alliance would not have come in to support President Karzai as the leader. It was Iran that convinced him, you know, the Northern Alliance to support. So they have almost exactly the same interest, especially as I suggested, in terms of drug trade and arms trade as well. And the fight against Sunni fundamentalism, Sunni radicalism, in the form of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, which considers Iran to be even worse than the Israeli state because Iran is a Shiite state. Heretics. However, this sanctions regime that is being imposed by the United States on Iran essentially gives Iran the incentive to what I call be naughty. Okay, that is to say, look, I'm a spoiler. If you want me to cooperate with you, you know, take those sanctions out. Let me sit on the table to be helpful. Okay? But if you're not going to, if you're going to make me insecure, I'm not going to let you have anyone in the neighborhood be secure. See, that's the point I was trying to make, that Iran, given its size, doesn't have the capability to confront the United States or United States allies directly, but it has the capability to be a spoiler. And it is very, very problematic policy to try to make Iran insecure, because that gives Iran the incentive to make everywhere else in the neighborhood insecure.
Thank you for speaking for us today. And I would like to ask, there's much portrayal in American news media, particularly in the more conservative outlets, of Iran's nuclear program being a danger to the region, specifically to Israel. And do you believe that the Iranian government is as flagrantly anti-Israel and hostile to the Israeli benefits that is being portrayed in the American media?
Iranian government is very anti-Israel. It's in the constitution of Iran that does not, like, it calls Israel a fabricated state. It's not a state that its existence, the Zionist regime. It never uses the term Israel. It says the Zionist regime. However, it's very important to understand what the Iranian government means by that. It means that it questions the legitimacy of the Israeli state as a Jewish state. The Iranian solution, that's why Iran was always accused of being against the Oslo process, was always against the two-state solution. Iran has always maintained, okay, that the Palestinian-Israeli issue will be resolved through an election in the whole Palestine. Of course, a free election in the whole Palestine, what does that mean? The end of the Jewish state politically. So Iran's opposition to Israel is not that if it produces a nuclear weapon, it'll go and dump a nuclear weapon in Israel. The Iranian foreign minister used to be fond of saying that Israel is actually the 51st state of United States. You know, we don't mess around with United States. No, he was really fond of saying that. And in any case, I mean, Iran is a defender of Palestinian rights. You know, you go and dump nuclear weapon on Israel, where will Palestinians go? What Iran means and why its threat is a threat to Israel is essentially this challenge, which, by the way, the Israeli government itself is making it increasingly more likely through its occupation policy. Most people are essentially talking about that the two-state solution is essentially dead by now. With the other challenge that Iran poses to Israel, and that's why I say it's better to talk about Israel and Iran not as enemies but as strategic competitors, is that everybody fears that if Iran becomes a nuclear-capable state, then, and here the problem is not only Israel, the Saudis, the other smaller Persian Gulf state, is the fear that Iran will become a bully. Okay, it becomes a hegemon in the region and tries to push everybody around. And again, I think that's a valid concern. But then you have this bigger power that is standing out there that, you know, only last year sold over $60 billion worth of weapons to the Gulf states. It's, you know, United States arms sales last year tripled, you know, using the Iran fear. I think it is a concern that should be addressed as far as Iran is concerned. However, it is not something that would make or should make negotiations impossible.
I'd like to thank Dr. Fari for coming to both Juneau and Anchorage and speaking to West High School and to us here today. And on behalf of the board of directors, I'd like to give you a book to remind you of your trip in Alaska and hope you come back. And I hope to see everyone at our next program on the 28th of November. It's a Wednesday as we're talking about Alaska's LNG opportunities and how that relates to the Asian markets, Japan, China. And we also have another program with a book here if anyone wants to pre-read. He's often called Mr. China, Jack Perkowski, who wrote this book, Managing the Dragon, How I'm Building a Billion-Dollar Business in China, will be here on the 14th of December. Thank you.
Thank you so much. much for coming out here. I wasn't born in the States. I was born in Mexico.
Okay.
And I know...
But you served in Afghanistan.
I served Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo.
Okay.
And I know what it takes to be an advocate of a nation that's not yours.